So the first slide is, and I won't read them, they're behind me, you can look at them, is just a list of our board of directors. We have, as you can see from the list, we have some pretty good diversity within the group, which leads to good discussion, good debate, from many different perspectives on all the things that we talk about. So the board is very well represented there. We do have room for a couple more board members, but we are diverse enough to have good conversations. In relation to our meetings, our first board meeting was in July of 2018, and our board meetings are held, are scheduled for the second Tuesday of each month. And I'm happy to say that up until this point, we have not had to reschedule any board meetings because of lack of quorum. And at most meetings, we have almost 100% participation, except for the last one, which was directly reflective of those involved with the World Curling. So attendance and running meetings is not an issue for the board. The board is there and very much engaged. Oh, there's another point, you can leave it there, Megan, that's okay. In relation to the board, one of the standing agenda items for the board is financial review and facility statistics review. So every month we take a look at where we are for revenue and expenses for the facility, what activity is happening in the facility, what any trends we can identify as either being in the right direction or in the wrong direction. And that has come from the result of a lot of hard work from Megan, Dana, and the staff at the Region of Queens to pull that stuff together, to give it to us in what is now a very meaningful way, and is used very much to frame the discussions for the board. So thank you for all the work that everybody's put into that. And I know it's not easy because information is coming from multiple sources. So to try to pull it together in something that works for everybody has been work for people, but the board is very happy with the information that they're receiving now. One of the other things that we look at very consistently is policy and guidelines. You'll see a couple of recommendations coming forward from that the board has endorsed in relation to ice cancellation and some of the not-for-profit use of the community room. We're also going to be moving forward reviewing all policies and guidelines within the facility. Although the facility for some may seem like it's been there forever, it really isn't that old. And a lot of the policies and procedures have just now over time begin to be tested and seen as to whether they meet the needs of what the facility has developed into or the directions that it's moving forward. And in some cases, there's maybe some gaps that are being identified that policies and procedures haven't been developed or don't exist for. So the board will be looking at all that are in place, and we have already recommended some changes on some of the ones that are there. We did sit with Megan and go through an extensive budget review, which again was well attended by board members. We went through the Queens County, the Queens Place revenue and expenses line for line, and Megan walked us through that, told us what was in there, what wasn't in there, where those numbers came from, how those numbers looked in previous years, and what some of the projections were for the upcoming years. And it was a very worthwhile exercise. Even for those people who've been around Queens Place for a while and on the board for a while, we've often seen numbers but not really sure what they meant. And I think now nobody would be able to look at a number and not know where that comes from and some history behind it. So again, a lot of work there put in to bring that information forward, but information that the board wanted and was engaged in that process as well. And you will, if you haven't already seen, see a few recommendations in relation to those budget reviews. Contracts and concert discussions. We do have a session set aside at each board meeting for in-camera discussions if we need them. And we have had a few over the years. Again, very interesting to see different perspectives when things are brought forward to the board from where board members come from and their interest and investment in the community. We very much want to, and I guess for lack of a better word, enjoy being part of those discussions. And Steve, for the most part, brings those forward. In some cases, Megan. Good, healthy relationships and discussions happen there as well. So good addition to the board. We've also recently done some work with Megan and her staff about trying to increase usage of the ice facility. in using the resources that are available to us through NORM. We are looking at bringing in some activities and some new things in what is considered to be non-prime ice hours when the ice is not being used, to gauge what interest may be out there in the community and moving forward in relation to offering opportunities or programming. But just really wanted to do a few little, for lack of a better word, pilots, or some things to see what kind of interest is out there. And so far, the response has been good, the feedback has been positive, and we look forward to doing that over the continuing months to try to maybe in some more long-term planning, see what types of activities can happen there during the time in which the ice sits vacant. Just a couple things that weren't on the slide I wanted to mention. We have had some great discussions both at the board level and through Megan and I with the farmers market, which has been an ongoing discussion point with Queen's Place. Some information has gone back to them and we're awaiting response with the farmers market, but we feel that all those discussions have been healthy for both of us, and whatever comes out of it will be what both parties will want. And we're just waiting to hear back from them again now. They're going to their annual meeting with some more information to their board to kind of see where they would want to go with this. So I know that has been a discussion point before, and we think we're moving that forward to a point of resolution for both parties. The other thing, just to pick up with what Chris had mentioned to Megan about Megan and Dave and moving forward, on behalf of the board of directors, I think there's, despite what the some of the bottom line numbers may look like in the facility, I think there's a great deal of optimism about the future for Queen's Place. Again, it is relatively new and it's like a build business. You're building a brand. You're building something from the ground up. And I think Queen's Place has laid a wonderful groundwork in almost every area in which the facility has some potential. And the good news is we haven't reached our potential. I think from a board of directors, we would feel much differently if we were sitting here saying the ice is utilized at 92% of the time and we're still running a huge deficit. Or that we have events in here every month and we're still running a huge deficit. The potential of that facility is still not tapped out, which leads, again, to a lot of optimism. And because of, I think, without question, and Megan can correct me if I'm wrong, kind of sitting here saying everything, and she certainly knows more than I do.
She's tired.
Yeah, take a nap if you want. I think without question, anything that Queen's Place and their staff and the community has laid their hands on has left a good impression with everybody involved. As a hockey parent who travels all around the Maritimes, I've yet to be anywhere where a hockey parent would not say they would not want to come to Queen's Place to play hockey. Yeah. From a concert perspective, I don't think you'd find a performer or a promoter or a spectator or fan who would say, I don't want to come to Queen's Place to watch something. From what you've just heard from a world facility, people around the world say everything here is fine. So I think we have wonderful building blocks to build upon. Yes, some of the numbers don't look great right now, and we're certainly aware of that, and we look at those as well. But with the potential that's there, if we continue to build and we look in different directions and do different things and keep an eye on those numbers, I think that we can continue to make Queen's Place be a centerpiece for recreational activity, social activity, economic activity, and health benefits for the community. So. And I think that's where the board comes at this from on a monthly basis. So that's really all I have. I can entertain, or Megan and I can answer if there are specific questions or things that people have.
Does anybody have any councilors have any questions?
Not a question, just a comment and a compliment, since we're in that mode today. But I just honestly, though, I really feel that, Mike, with your leadership with the board, it's been really great to work with you. You've been presenting us with, you know, agenda items through the assistance of Megan and you know, we've really been productive, mm-hmm. and that is really good for boards to be able to see. And you know, as you say, there's a lot of challenges, but I think we're on the right track to be able to address those. And I know the community perspective now of Queen's Place from its usage and what has happened over the last number of years, there's more proud in our community for Queen's Place than it ever even thought of would, you know, that would be out there. So solo. And Megan, I mean, she's just adding a real flair to the area, and great working with you too, Megan, because you've been able to give us all the information we need, digging in your files and getting all the, you know, the figures and whatnot that we need in order to make those decisions and then come back to council who makes the final decisions. But I think all the groundwork is laid, and I really appreciate that as a board member.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Councilor Clancy?
Something a little bit off the topic, but on the same thing. I was watching on the news last night, and we were talking about Sydney with the, you know, the curling event, of course, they had up there with the Scotty. He said, they had over 400 volunteers. He said, we had over just over 200 and got the same thing done. So it shows you how our volunteers do it. I said, they had over 400 volunteers. I said, wow. We only had 200 and something and got the same thing done. It shows you the work that people do. They don't just, they don't just stand there as a body.
Right.
It shows a more, I'm not saying they didn't put the effort up there too, but now look at the facilities they're showing up there in the seats looking down. It's like, ours doesn't look like that. Ours looks so much better. If you're looking down, of course, that's a, you know, it's a, but it gives a sense of pride of how the, even the beginning was set up properly. You don't have a base.
Mm-hmm.
You can't correct it. You know, you can't correct those things that are there. So I look at it and say, as you look forward, is there things that, coming back forward to us, you see that we need to be looking at, I guess, as other than, you know, that's, we're looking from the outside in, we're looking from the inside out, so.
I think you'll see a few recommendations this year from budget. I would say in moving forward, now having the base upon which to build upon, you'll see more things. There are a couple items that we are looking at that aren't at this point ready to able to make any firm recommendations. One is the ice in, ice out in the summertime, which has been discussed in the past before. We continue to compile information from Megan and her staff. And again, Dave's left the other meeting. We spent almost an hour down in Dave's little room looking at schematics and how the system works and what is feasible and what is not feasible. So that's kind of on the radar for us. Usage for ice time and some of the things that Norm's doing now, I think, is a huge opportunity for us. What that ends up looking like and what things may come back to council and asking for support there are a bit unknown. We'll see what Norm's able to bring back and the facility's able to bring back to us over the next little bit. So I think there will be more, and I guess the only thing I can say there's the good thing is right now we're not boxed into any one line of thought or any one line of thing. We're looking at all options and all opportunities. Also, the excuse me, in relation to ice in, ice out, we have highlighted that in the expense stream, that power costs are one of the huge drivers of Queen's Place. What kind of options or opportunities may be there to reduce those in relation to modern, newer types of technologies and those types of things. So those, again, are in discussions, and I suspect at some point we'll probably see some recommendations come back to council in relation to that as well.
Councilor Fisk?
Thank you for being here today and good presentation. First of all, I'm very proud of the Queen's Place. One thing I've learned through the 6 years I've been here, there was always talk about the deficit of the facility, what have you. But if you look through the 6 years, well, in my past 6 years, the deficit goes down every year to a little bit. I never did worry about the deficit. If everybody in Queens would understand, in the region of Queens, throughout the spinoff that creates in our area, and the different the events that go on in that place, it's just brought life to this whole region. I'm really proud to say that we have that facility, and I would put it up against one of the best facilities in the province of Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. Just want you all to know that. And again, I'm very proud to be a part of it.
Any other councilors have questions? Thank you very much. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you. So Next on the agenda is the tabling of petitions. Are there any petitions to be tabled? Calling once, petitions to be tabled, twice, petitions to be tabled, three times, petitions to be tabled. No, thank you very much. And I think now we're on to Leon. We've waited patiently, Leon, you're up.
No, just carrying on there from, with respect to the world crew that was here, I heard the great form of the chair of the committee that put that together on the radio this morning, and he gave a very good report and said that the attendance was very good for what they anticipated. And from my point of view, it looks as though we've put a little Liverpool on the world map. And good job, right on. Thank you. The other thing, I was here for a portion of the meeting yesterday with respect to the budget, and I gathered there, I was able to save the whole thing, I gathered there that you're looking at the possibility of a 3 to 3.5% tax rate, increase in the tax rate. And I noticed also that our biblical material, when I get home, there's a few projects here that have limestone. I assume that you've eliminated those at this point in time, such as those 2 acres, the bandstand that it is for the park on the river and so on.
That's correct.
So I realize there's more discussions, and that this is certainly not the final figure that you're up to at this point. You have another meeting that is coming up on before you go to the tax rate.
The budget is still in draft until it comes back to from staff to council for approval.
Right. Okay, thank you. And as I mentioned to you, you're right here, CDCL people are coming here, I guess, for an update of the presentation on the waterfront.
Correct.
Okay, I have a meeting, I have to return to that.
We'll see you at 1 o'clock.
I hope.
Thank you, Leon. Okay, so approval of the minutes. Thank you, Councilor McLeod. And second, Councilor Frelick. Any questions? Any questions about the any discussion on the minutes? No? Thank you. All in favor of approval of the minutes? It's unanimous. Thank you. And then we move on to item 6.1. Oh, sorry, those are the minutes. We move on to item 7.0, nothing on dangerous and unsightly premises. 8.0, nothing on economic development. And then 9.0, we have corporate services request for increase in grant funding, Queens County Senior Safety Association. Senator Lowe, did you want to speak to that?
I can. There's a report in your package that was circulated prior to today's meeting. We received a request from the Queens County Senior Safety looking for an increase in their funding from $5,000 in the upcoming fiscal year to $10,000. The report highlights what the money would be used for and the recommendation of staff that we continue next year with the continuation of $5,000, that we don't increase to $10,000. Based on the fact that they're operating with a $17,000 surplus, and certainly that's enough to for another $5,000 a year for another 3 years without any additional funding from us. And so rather than us give them the money to continue to pad their surpluses, it would be appropriate, I would think, for council to continue to fund them at the actual level. And if there was a time in the future when they did need extra money, then council should give serious consideration to it in the future for when the actual financial need is present.
Point of order, Deputy Mayor.
Yeah.
Should have the motion should be missed.
Yes. Would anybody like to take Councilor Fisk?
I so recommend that the Council of the Region of Queens Municipality approve $5,000 in grant funding to the Queens County Senior Safety Association from its 2019-2020 operating budget.
Thank you. Second. Councilor Hughes. And discussion and questions? Councilor McLeod.
Being on that committee, first of all, the recommendation says provide 5,000 in grant funding. Well, that's already in our budget for 2019. It should say an additional 5,000. Is that correct?
No, we're not recommending that we give an additional $5,000. We're recommending
to keep it at $5,000. Okay.
Correct.
I'm not sure.
Oh, this is the staff recommendation.
Any other questions? No, I'm ready for the question.
Question.
All those in favor? Unanimous.
Can I just make a comment there regarding the senior safety? At the current time, there is an application note for replacement of the senior safety coordinator. The current one has resigned and is moving to Ontario, so they're hoping to hire a new one within the next several months.
Thank you, Councilor McLeod. And we will, I think what we'll do is, the next on the list is the CDCL, and that's at 1 o'clock, their presentation. We'll skip over that for now. At 11.0 is finance, nothing on finance, and at 12.0, recreation and community facilities, operational policy 12.1, operational policy 79, clean space and air center facility usage, not for profit. Recommendation, yes, Megan, we'll come forward for that.
Yes.
And so, Sue would like to take the lead on 12.1. Councilor Frohlich?
I so move that the Council of the Region of Queens Municipality approve amended operational policy 79, Queens Place on Air Center facility usage, non for profit community group.
And a second? Councilor Fitz?
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Don't fight.
No, we
won't
fight.
She doesn't see my hand.
I know.
She's like that.
I think the report says most of it, but so as part of the board of directors, what we're doing is looking at all of our policies and guidelines, as Mike indicated in his presentation, and this is one that we were specifically looking at. So they had requested in doing that I provide them with a list of people using it under not-for-profit, and they identified two specific groups that they didn't feel the policy was intended for to use it under that. So that's the change you're seeing today. If you go to the proposed changes, which is on the second page. So we'd like to exclude political parties, and then the other administrative changes. We now have an application we require everyone to complete when they are using under that policy. We ask for their Nova Scotia Joint Registry of Stocks number, along with who can book under the policy for the organization. We had some issues with them using the policy in order to get half the room for free and trying to book the other half. So we've looked to just tighten up some of the things that we've come into as issues. And those are the other changes that you'll see there. I can answer any questions.
Any questions? You ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor? Unanimous. Thank you. And 12.2, tournament special events assistant program. Who wants to take the lead on 12.2? Councilor Muse?
Move that the Council of the Region of Queens Municipality give budget approval for the tournament special events assistant grant of $500 to Gary Al Winsel, tournament chair, to help with the costs associated with the hosting the 2019 Gary Al Winsel March Break Tournament. And that is to be funded from the Community Grants and Programs budget line of the Recreation and Healthy Communities Department.
And a second? Councilor Frohlich.
So this is an annual tournament. It's hosted out of three different arenas, ours being one of them. And it's various levels of rentals the last couple of years. Last year it was not a significant amount. This year they have the biggest tournament they've ever had. which is great. We have three local teams participating in it, and it's again spread over the three rinks. So they have a total of 49.75 hours rented at Queens Place over March break, which is great for us, brings people into the community, and so we'd like to support it.
Any questions? I just have one question myself.
Sure.
They're asking for $1,000, and we're giving $500. Is that because that's the limit on that policy?
Correct. That is the policy.
Right. And they weren't required to submit. They didn't submit anything else other than their letter. And they're not required to submit a any kind of a budget for that.
So we're still under previous policy for this one. So under the Community Investment Fund, the new policy doesn't come into effect until April 1st. So I still go back to all these organizations, and I have additional information that they've provided me since their request came in. And following the tournament, we'll certainly ask for a report on how it went and their costs associated with it. But moving forward, those will always be. Right now, it's not even, there's not an application form for it. They're just required to send me a letter, as you see, that's attached here. Yeah.
Can I ask a question of Megan? And it is about the current policy and the new policy that's coming effective April 1st. So when you had a deadline for applicants for funding for certain specific purposes, that was, I think, February the 1st or whatever was a deadline. Is that under this new policy?
So the only deadline under the current new, or not the current, the new policy would be January 31st for operating. The rest of them, the intake is all throughout the year, depending on when they have events happening or activities. But of course, I mean, it's subject to budget. So if we do run out of money because of the asks, you know, it is first come, first serve.
Okay.
But the only deadline is that January 31st was for the operating.
Operating one.
Yep.
So if an organization wanted to apply for funding, an event, would it be under the new policy now, or would they be under the old policy?
Well, right now, for the other ones, I still have budget left. And this, if I had no budget, I wouldn't have brought this forward, correct? But so I have my current budget that obviously ends on March 31st, and then come April 1st, it's all under the new policy, and the other ones were repealed.
Okay. But the applications that they get are the new, under the new investment policy.
Correct.
Thank you. And any other questions? Is everyone ready for the question? All those in favor? Thank you, Megan.
You're welcome.
Planning 13.0, nothing under planning. 14.0 reports, council implementation report. We've all had the report to look at. Does anybody have any questions about the report? No? Thank you. And now, if I could have a motion to go in camera, 15.0 in camera. Thank you, Councillor Frelick, and seconded by Councillor McLeod. All those in favor? Thank you, unanimous. And then we'll be in camera now. Credit, sir. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank
Let
you.
Us know when you're ready.
We're, I think you're ready.
And if you're ready, we're ready. Are we ready? Yes.
Okay. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
My name is Colin Fisher. I'm with CBCL. This is Victoria Fernandez. And we're here to give you a presentation on the coastal mitigation study that we've been working on. We submitted a draft report to you guys, was it 2 or 3 weeks ago now? We've received some initial comments, but we were asked to present it. So here we are. So the first part that I'd like to talk about is what we're going to talk about. So the first thing we'll run through is what the project scope was, who the study team was and who CBCL is. We'll talk a little bit about the climate change in general as an overview, as it is the kind of the foundation of what we are talking about here today, and then the associated flood risk and mitigation options, as well as our preliminary recommendations. As we're going here, please feel free to interrupt me and ask questions along the way. You can see, I guess the photos that we have there, we did a little bit of research into historical photos and put those two photos side by side to give a sense of what the waterfront looks like today compared to what it looked like in 1945 and before. The yellow line is intended to represent sort of the what we see as being where the original shoreline was and what's been infilled over time. So the scope of our assignment was to complete a conceptual design for potential flood mitigation, and part of that would include an analysis of the site, so basically the downtown and the associated parking lot near the Visitors Information Center. We looked at long-term sea level predictions. We looked at what we think development levels should be, and we looked at what's existing now for access to the waterfront and what could be there going forward. We looked at potential mitigation options for the parking lot area specifically. And we looked at short-term and long-term costs associated with that parking lot. And then the other part of our scope, which we haven't done yet, because it depends on what the recommendations are and what the municipality would like to do, is we had allowed for details designed for mitigation of the parking lot area. So just a quick little bit about CBCL. For those of you who aren't familiar with us, we've been around since 1955. We're over 300 people. A lot of our people are in Halifax, but we have several offices around the Atlantic provinces. Our roots were around municipal and transportation projects, and over time we've expanded to provide complementary services to those, as well as mechanical, electrical, instrumentation, and structural engineering as well. The team that's working on this project, myself, I'm the project manager and a senior civil engineer. I've been working on various types of civil and multidisciplinary projects for the last 20 years. A lot of my experience is in transportation related projects, including bridges, roads, subdivisions. And Victoria, maybe talk a little bit about your background.
I'm a water resources and coastal engineer with CBCL. I joined the team in 2011, but I've been doing this type of studies for more than 10 years. And I have been responsible for defining what are the water levels, extreme water levels that you can potentially observe at the waterfront, and for designing and sizing stormwater measurements that are associated with some of the mitigation measures.
You can see on that slide a map of Nova Scotia. I don't know if it's kind of hard to see the stars, but you know, you can see there's about a dozen similar assessments that we've done around the province. Some of them are fairly large, like Chester and Lunenburg were for the whole municipality, as examples. Sydney was a fairly large study that we've done recently following the flooding that they had in, what year was that,
2016?
16. So we've, I'd like to think that as far as, you know, the Maritimes go, we definitely have one of the more experienced teams when it comes to climate change and its potential impacts to the region. You'll also see we've got Alex Wilson. He's our practice lead for water resources, so he's involved in the background on all of our projects. And he's Victoria's supervisor, and Rick Giffen. He's a senior civil engineer in our group who has been involved at sort of a high level reviewing what our potential options are, and providing some senior guidance on the technical aspects of the project. He's done quite a bit of work in the municipality as well, and in Liverpool in particular. You know, he'd been involved in a lot of the previous design work around downtown and around Water Street and Henry Hensley in the parking lot. So maybe Victoria, do you want to talk a little bit about climate change in general?
Absolutely. So basically, climate change has been, it's not new, it's not a new issue. It's certainly raising a lot of concerns throughout the globe, and Nova Scotia, it's not different. There is strong evidence that suggests that basically the polar caps are melting, and that melting, especially towards the north, doesn't necessarily translate immediately in sea level rise, but it's an indicator of how changes in temperature are happening. The panel to my right, it's just a shot that shows how in about 32 years the polar caps have reduced. And in Antarctic, in the towards the South Pole, if this continues to be the trend, then this will translate likely in sea level rise. Observations in the tide gauge that it's located in Halifax show how a constant increase in sea level rise at the harbor, and that would be the case for Lunenburg as well.
Here, I'll jump. Another, I can jump ahead to the next slide there, and we can come back to that one in a minute.
Absolutely.
If you'd like.
So, and there are still some projections on how that sea level rise can manifest in the next 20 to 100 years. The initial estimates were of about a meter in 100 years, but there is a strong scientific evidence that shows that trend actually is accelerating. So what we thought that we might see in 100 years, we might be seeing sooner than that. That's in terms of sea level rise. Another consequence of climate change, it's actually rainfall intensity. As the temperature rises, then evaporation processes also increase, and the trend is actually, the calculations are that rainfall intensity, it's going to increase by approximately 30%. So in our study, we basically have collected the latest tools and the latest background on sea level rise estimates for Nova Scotia and rainfall changes for Nova Scotia. One thing that compounds with the trend of sea level rise is what we called crustal subsidence, which is basically that as the ice caps melt, then it's like this happens. The weight of the ice cap basically push the center of the continent, and as they smelt, the continental shelf starts doing like this. And because we are towards the edges, then we tend to sink. And that it's compound with the trend that it's caused by the changes in temperature in the volume of water. In our analysis, when we study flood risk and we study what we call extreme water levels, there is also the considerations not only on the level of the high tides and in the future and sea level rise, but also the effect of storm surges. And there were studies conducted in 2011 that looked at the storm surges in different tide gauges throughout the province and throughout actually the Atlantic, and then they came up with this figure there that shows more or less the storm surge, the different levels of storm surge throughout the area. A storm surge basically is what we define as the difference between the predicted tide levels, which is something that we can predict because they are the a result of the position of the moon and the earth, plus a certain rise in water level that happens with difference in pressure. So all those components are compounded to generate extreme water levels.
So maybe just
in the coastal area.
To just
talk a little bit more about these couple of figures because they're fairly important in the grand scheme of things for sea level rise, and just wanted to make sure that it's kind of understood what we're showing here. So basically, this part of the line for actual sea level, that's the gauge reading of the who's the owner of that particular gauge? Is it
DFO? DFO.
Within the Halifax Harbor, that's mapping the. The annual mean sea level then, over time. So you can see how it's starting to climb. And what these lines are three different
projections
of where sea level will go based on continuing the trend that we're seeing locally. These are more of a global trends that have been a match to our particular condition here in Nova Scotia.
Except for the blue one and the red one. The blue one and the red one are local. The bottom ones.
Oh, these two, okay.
Yes, those two. So basically, but in the end, all what that line shows, it's a tree strand, right? It's going up. It has had a trend, which is the black line, that it's what we have seen historically, and then there are these other lines that project what the future is going to be. However, because these processes are so complex, science is not yet at a point to determine with a high degree of certainty what is it going to be. So we are using the in our design, we're using the one of the conservative approaches. What was considered as conservative in 2013, although at this point it's not, which is what they call the 8.5 scenario. And that 8.5 scenario was projecting some reduction in the carbon emissions, such that some control in carbon emissions was achieved. But that hasn't been the case, and we all know that there is a global struggle towards improving that.
So, I mean, the uncertainty here really is between, the full range. So, in the year 2100, based on the various, whatever prediction you decide you want to settle on, it could be somewhere between, 0.75, 0.8 meter sea level rise, all the way up to almost 2 meters. And I think, like Victoria mentioned, for the work that we've been doing, that informs design, We've been recommending a sort of a middle of the road approach to balance short term cost versus long term risk, I guess is really what it boils down to.
And one of the challenges that it's inherent to flood risk study is that there is always an event that can be bigger than the one you designed for. So basically, that's kind of the message that this slide tries to convey. As in 2016, like Colin was mentioning, Sydney had approximately 225 millimeters of rainfall, something that wasn't seen before. So it doesn't matter if you design for 100 years, there is always the chance to see a 200-year event. We also saw what happened in St. John last year. When basically the St. John River decided to claim its floodway, in Fredericton. And unfortunately, human settlement has developed around water. That's basically our history. It's the history of our entire civilization. And now that we have grown and we have more population, that means that we are more exposed and there is more risk. So the tendency, the late tendency and the latest discovery in flood risk management is that we can't talk about mitigation as opposed to trying to change the narrative from solutions to mitigation, because there is the recognition that we are always at risk and trying to adapt to climate change and trying to look for sustainable solutions would be the most cost-effective approaches in the long term, not only in the short term, but in the long term. Solutions that allowed for adaptation. So in the in our more on this talk, more on this showing what type of impact and what type of risks we are, the town is exposed to and we have identified. At the moment in 2020, the 100 year level, which is basically calculated as the high tide and a storm surge on top caused by pressure difference in the differences in the environment, it's 2.4. The edge of of the parking lot, it's a 1.7 meters. So there is approximately 0.7 meters difference between a 100 year level and the front part of the parking lot. And this is visualized better in another slide. What we're trying to show here is how that 2.4 goes throughout the years from being something that has a 1% chance of happening every year to in 2100, potentially even before that. By that time, it's going to be the normal high water large tide. So in about maybe less than 80 years, the entire parking lot will be covered twice a day. So that's the purpose of this.
I mean, even now,
this slide.
We were here in November, late October, and we have to be here right at spring high tide and to kick off this project. And you know, at that time, we happened to be here right at the right time, and water was backflowing into the parking lot up through the catch basins. You know, where there were puddles around the catch basins, just because that's where high tide is. So it's definitely a challenge. And what we were trying to show here with this little snapshot here as well is that basically your 2.4 meter level corresponds with just inside of this contour and stretches along. So really, this intersection is pretty darn close to this kind of worst case scenario today. And then in the future, the worst case scenario for storm surge is about a meter higher than that, which is where this contour falls. So sort of halfway between Water Street and Main Street. And this here is obviously quite a bit lower than there. I think that's right around 2 meters, maybe just a little less.
Yeah, and also to put things in perspective, at least once a year, the coastal water levels are about maybe 1 to 2 feet only from the top of the parking lot. So that puts things a little bit in perspective. I think one of the realities about the setting of Liverpool is that actually the ground in that area is low, which poses some challenges for protection against coast and at the same time managing stormwater flows. But we will get to that. So this slide also shows it's a graphic translating basically these numbers into floods. So when we talk about the yellow contours, you can see that we are saying that 1.9 meters, can you see the mouse there? Yeah, 1.9 meters, which is this, by 2 years we mean that there is a chance that there is more than a 50% chance to observe an event like this each year. 1.9, it's able to cover everything that you see there in yellow. So basically, the Henry Hensy Drive and Water Street can be covered. And you have seen that before. You saw it in 2013, that's basically not news. The blue line, it's basically the event that has approximately 1% of happening each year if it coincides with high water large tide.
So the boundary between the two blues, correct? So where the light blue intersects with the dark blue.
Yeah, so everything that is under light blue will be covered by water. The other two, the dark blue and the purple one, show more in the, like one in the future event, which would be what you could expect in 2070, maybe before, if the trend continues. And the pink line is just showing an example of what would happen if Hurricane Juan made a landslide here in Liverpool.
Made landfall here.
Landfall, sorry. Not landslide. Landfall. My English is not very good looking today. But anyway, so instead of doing it in Halifax. So that's that puts in perspective basically the risks that we're at. Even if you select, for example, and then as an exercise, say that you want to be, decide that you want to be protected against the one, the 2 year flood or the 2 year event, and then you decide to take measures that protect you against at a 1.9 meter water level, then you're still exposed for something that can happen every year anyway that can reach a water level of 2.4 meters. So basically that's why we talk about risk management. It's about making the decision of how much risk you want to take. This it zooms out towards not only the parking lot area, but the entire Liverpool downtown. Mm-hmm. And we can, with this, identify several areas that are at risk, including wharves, maybe the proximities of the water treatment plant, and some other areas that are valuable and fundamental for the community. So even if we might take care of the parking lot or the town decides to take part of the parking lot, but in the short to long term, the other areas around the downtown area are also vulnerable to flooding. So in terms of mitigation options, there are basically 4 to 5 standard ways of dealing with flooding. The one that we have done so far, it's called holding the line. And that's what they are doing in the Netherlands, and that's what they did in the Thames rivers in London, and that's what they have been doing in the Bay of Fundy for 300 years, which is basically constructing structural barriers that protect us, air quotes, from flooding. However, and these structures, when they are properly designed, they have been effective. But as time goes by, and as we have been learning from situations like Katrina, we become aware that these structural measures have limits. They require maintenance. They require maintenance. They have a limited life cycle. And they are always designed for a certain event. There is always that event that is bigger that can make it fail, like it happened in Katrina, and like it has happened in the Awato in Hansport, and there are multiple examples like that. So other mitigation options include planned retreat. In the face of climate change, in the face of sea level rise, and the incremental in the high cost of protecting, creating huge infrastructure to protect what is existing there, then the calculations show that this might not be sustainable or the most cost-effective ways to deal with a situation that is going to caught up with us. So in many places, retreating it's used as a mitigation option. Limited intervention. It's also a way, which is basically focusing on, for medium to short term, basically working with the climate as it's come, and then basically adapting to it. If you have an area that is usually flooded, and it's going to be too expensive to flood, and you can change the land uses, and you can accommodate the land uses for the flooding risks, then that's an effective way of dealing with flooding risks.
Like what that image is showing there is, you know, an example of that would be, you know, you have a house on a floodplain. So, mm-hmm. you know, maybe it's just, you know, in an isolated spot, rather than building, you know, a kilometer worth of dike, you know, it's often more cost effective just to take that one house and raise it up.
And avoid, of course, which is basically what planning and developing strategies are responsible for. And it's defining what are those areas at risk and preventing development in those areas. It's more and more a recent approach, or you know, in the last maybe 100 years, when people and Civilization and Societies identify that rivers flood, and they claim their floodplain, and that the coastal water levels also change over time and cause damages. So these slides basically shows similar examples that have been used around the world, specifically in Europe. The Netherlands is one of the leading examples or leading societies that have to deal with water and have to learn to live with it. In some cases, they build barriers when they have huge and expensive infrastructure to protect and revenues and have revenues that can cover for those expenses. And in cases where this is not feasible, then there are options that allow you to live with the water. Example of water crossings that are constructed with blocks and let the water go through, still allowing people to pass. In other areas, they are able to hold storm water and store storm water for a time, and at the same time make a recreational park that allows.
It's hard to see what that is, but it's like a little amphitheater that's recessed. So you know, in times of a rainfall event, there's somewhere for water to go, but it's still useful. At other times.
There are also some other examples. Like in Portugal, they have boardwalks that basically are allowed to float, and they are constructed to be allowed to float. In Halifax, we have a similar. We are right now developing detailed design with a similar context. In that case, this will be located in the northwest arm, and instead of building a big protective wall because of geotechnical and constructability limitations, we basically did a stagger solution that allows walking during the summer, but it's meant to get flooded over the winter and when the water rises. So I guess I'm getting ahead of the discussion because these slides were more to discuss the option that we presented as less costly and more feasible, which was basically bringing the potential idea of changing land uses. Do you want to take this?
Yeah, I can take over. I mean, we threw a few photos in of what the waterfront of Halifax is, and Dartmouth too, on Alderney Landing. You know, where there's more susceptible areas. They're making them more open public spaces with, maybe a bit more resilient infrastructure. And that one in the bottom right corner, for example. This is Victoria, if anybody recognizes it. Summertime, real busy spot, probably at this time of the year, maybe as well. Repurposing the areas to be a little bit more resilient, in this case, sort of temporary kiosks or seasonal type businesses. So as part of the project here, what we were asked to do was look at potential mitigation options for the parking lot. Anybody have any questions up to this point before I jump into potential solutions for the parking lot? The first place we went when we jumped into this project was, let's figure out a way to make a seawall work. So what we did was we looked at the overall topography of the area. I'm actually going to back up a little bit just to look at this guy. So you can see here, there's sort of a natural high point over here. It didn't come in on this figure, but there is also a natural high point just over here that sort of isolates this area to.
See it there. You can see it?
Yeah. So right here to this level, which happens to be real close to that 1-in-100-year flood line that we're looking at today. So the 2.4, 2.5 meter range. I think it was 2.44 is what it actually worked out to be. But I think throughout the design process, we were looking at 2.5 meters as a nice round number that's easy to deal with.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking now about the bridge.
Yep.
The bridge would be flooded in that area.
It's problematic for the, for dealing with the solution down here, absolutely.
And Market Street as well.
Yeah,
well,
it really limits.
Cut off from, you'd be cut off.
You could be. And it really limits what you can do. If this bridge stays the same, you know, putting any kind of money into something that would be higher than this 2.4 meter level, you know, you're then all of a sudden you're chasing yourself out for kilometers in either direction, and it's sort of a tipping point for, you know, a manageable project to a very large, difficult to manage initiative, and so that's why, as we're getting into this, that's why we looked at, for any kind of a solution for the short term, that's likely the number that you would design to, right around that 2.5 meter range, because after you get past that point, it's a much, much bigger issue. So, go back to the right slide here. So for option one, what we looked at was, okay, so let's try to protect from about here to about here, so that we have a constant elevation all the way across at about 2.5 to prevent anything up to that level of spilling into the parking lot. So that's what this red line would represent. And then there's another small berm that you would require over here to protect this particular lot. Again, there's a bit of a high point here. So by doing that, you can keep the seawater out at times of the 100 storm surge that we talked about. But then it creates another problem, is that if you have a rain event around the same time, now all of a sudden you've created a bathtub. And you can see here, this figure over on the right shows the catchment area for all of the stormwater that wants to come down to this spot. And it's quite large. Now, granted, there's some of that would make its way through the existing storm systems, but we're talking about a 100-year event, or, you know, a large event where the storm systems aren't designed to handle that. They're typically allowed to overflow, and overland flow takes over at that time. So for large storm events, a lot of this water will end up in this area. And I suspect you've all seen that at times. So in order to deal with that, we need to figure out how to get the water out, you know, as fast as it comes in. So what we did was we chose a 1 in 100 year rainfall event to model. Now there's debate about whether or not it should be 1 in 100. You know, when you're using a 1 in 100 year storm surge event, you know, what's the likelihood of those both happening at the same time? And Victoria can expand on that.
So basically, the question for design, because I'm going to, so I can help, so I have, it, I'm trying to be eloquent here.
This is your,
thank you.
If you want the pointers, the little red button
sure.
On top.
So I'm going to back up a little and as Colin was explaining, like all these lines basically are what we call contour lines. And what they do is that they indicate what's the elevation to a datum of each of the land. And when you see them like that, basically these are the higher points and these are the lower points. So you can see that basically the water is going to go like this. So right now, any storm, it's able to run freely from here to there. Mm-hmm. The minute that you put a blockage there, you need to be prepared to handle that flow no matter the size, right? Because if a 2 year or a small storm, rainfall, let's call it rainfall, it's going to find an obstruction here, and a 100-year one, it's also going to find an obstruction here. And like Colin was saying, sewer systems are designed to handle only smaller rainfall events. Anything else, it's supposed to run freely through the roads and through the ditches until it reaches an outlet. So the question is, okay, what do you design for? What happens if you have a strong rainfall event and it's not like there's going to be a storm surge at the waterfront, but there is some storm, because it's the same, it's a huge weather event that caused the rainfall to come, and at the same time it comes associated with changes of pressure and some storm surge. Given the fact that the waterfront is relatively low, there is not much head or much difference in elevation for the water to run, and that means that your wall needs to be high enough that if the water levels rise a little bit in the coast, your storm water is not going to be able to leave. So, and that's going to be the case for a small storm that have, for a small rainfall that happens at high water, or for a big rainfall that happens with a little bit of storm surge. And the intention is not to change one risk for the other. You don't want to trade, we think that the intention is not to trade coastal flooding for stormwater flooding. So in order to give, to provide a similar level of flood mitigation, then you need to be, the design needs to focus in a bad case scenario for rainfall and bad case scenario for water level. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Question for you.
Sure.
Well, you're talking about building up wall, so then your weak point is going to be at the end of the wall where the elevation is going to be to the lowest spot of where the ground is.
Correct.
So you've got to have that. You can only build up as high with the wall that would make it not go past the end of that wall on the end, because if anything more, it would just go around the wall. It's going to flood you anyway.
Right, and
exactly.
Eventually you get to the point where you're chasing your tail.
Yes.
And you know, you get a point of limiting returns, and then all of a sudden you take another big leap. That's what I was talking about earlier about that.
Right.
But that 2.4, 2.5 meter range seems to
right.
be the point where, the tipping point where, you know, goes from a manageable project to a much larger project that
right.
that would cost a lot more money.
So, in other words, basically, the case that of the seawall is basically this case you have here. The water from rainfall comes like this, and but it encounters an obstruction. And at the same time, the wall has to basically surround the low area, which is, I think, what you were saying,
mm-hmm.
it has to surround the area so the water, the storm water, doesn't come to the sides. So basically, water levels right now, water levels will, as an illustration, it will basically oscillate from high water and a storm surge to low water, right? So if you have a rainfall event that comes like this and encounters water level to this point, imagining that you can put there some tidal gate or something, then still the water is going to back up and it's going to flood everything that's behind the wall.
Just because of the not limited head difference from one side to the other, water can only get out so fast, no matter how open you make it. So,
excuse me.
Yep.
Is ours not unique as well? Because we're talking about man-made parking lots.
Yes.
Is, you know, you can put a wall, but the water's still coming up through.
Yep.
And so everything that we've seen so far is trying to prevent a man-made area from flooding.
Correct.
Which
so
was never meant to be, should never have been a parking lot to start with, according to these figures.
Yeah,
it looks
I
like
mean.
We're, it looks like we're only trying to protect those areas that were never meant to be.
Yeah, the challenge with that is that you have, you know, half a dozen buildings here that are you know, within the risk area.
Yeah.
You know, I think actually you guys are probably better off than some other communities in that respect, where, you know, I think, you know, you think of Sydney as a good example where, you know, I think there's a lot more infrastructure that is in the danger zone that makes it a much more difficult task to manage. And, you know, there may be a little more surrounded. My new Liverpool is kind of surrounded as well, but you have high ground that's fairly close to the edge of the current riverbanks and shore banks. So, to that, just to talk about a couple of those points that you made, you know, for example, one of the issues with putting a seawall there, it can't just, it's a simple berm isn't going to work. So you couldn't just come in and put, you know, stone or gravel or rock or clay or anything, concrete, just at the top. The problem, one of the biggest problems there is that, you know, there's a number of old wharves still under here. And no matter what you do, unless you figure out how to cut that off completely, right down to the existing sea bottom, you're still going to have water sloshing in and out, no matter how impermeable this is. It's going to come in from underneath and then flood up through the bottom of the parking lot, and you know you're back to square one. So through our cost estimated exercise, you'll see right there. It's hard to see, but the intent would be for this particular option that would be a sheet pile wall that would go all the way down through anything that's there into the existing sea bottom, through all the existing storm infrastructure, cut all those pipes off, and then we would reinstate them in a you know, essentially a watertight fashion, or kind of integrated with part B of this. So the other part of this obviously is, okay, how do you deal with rainfall now that you've got a bathtub? Well, really the only way to defeat that is with some sort of a pump system. And in order to have a reasonably sized pump, you have to have a little bit of storage so it has a chance to come in and have sort of a place to buffer while you fire up the pumps and get it going and then evacuate the area. So for this exercise, we used a 1 in 100 year stormwater event and we sized pumps. So for this particular alternative, we had a pumping capacity of 30,000 gallons per minute, which is substantial. Very, like, it's like a somewhere between a 24 and a 36 inch force main that would be traveling at, I think it was 2 meters per second, 2.5 meters per second through that force main at peak discharge. And with that, you still need a 1 to 2 meter deep storage pond about the size of that box. And that's for the 1 in 100 event. And, you know, you can argue that, you know, is that what you protect to here? You know, I don't know. I think that's a tough decision. And then, of course, you need redundancy and backup power if you're going to do that. So you need 2 30,000. Actually, we ended up going with, I think in our option, we looked at maybe 4 pumps. You would have 3 pumps that would scale up to create the capacity that you would need. So 3 of them would give you the full 30,000 gallons per minute, and then the 4th one would be backup in case 1 would fail. And then you can actually cycle through all of them during smaller events to keep them all running and in good condition. So as you can see, you know, that storage, there's different ways you can do it. You can do it underground. You can use, you know, there's new technology out there for creating storage space underneath parking lots, where they're sort of semi-permeable, but you know, they get expensive. You could do underground storage tanks, but I mean, you can imagine that footprint, extremely costly. So for our cost estimating exercise, we looked at the least costly alternative, just being a pond or a recess that could accept that. And the challenge there is you have to keep it somewhat drained. You can't allow it to fill up. You need to be ready for the storm event. So, you know, you could have a bit of a, you know, a water feature park type thing. You know, it wouldn't have to be rectangle. You know, could be you know, any kind of shape. But we still have to have a significant amount of volume, and essentially, you know, eliminate your parking lot. And then those businesses would also, you know, have challenges with enough space, and you know, it would limit access to your visitor information center. I don't know how you did it. Maybe it could be a couple of different ponds. But anyway, it's got, that particular solution has its challenges. And we can talk about the cost estimate here when we get through the 3 options. The figure above, I don't know how easy it is to see, but I'm trying to see where, it's really fuzzy. It's hard to tell which one is the existing surface there. Sorry, just give me a sec. Yeah, so the dashed line here is where the existing parking lot surface is. The red line is what we're suggesting being sort of the minimum design level for mitigation. And you can see, obviously, it's almost flat. And even over here, it might even be lower than the majority of it. When I happen to be here in November, at high spring tide, there's a catch basin right in front of the waterfront plaza here, and it's right there. And when I was there, the water was within an inch of the top of the catch basin, and I suspect that happens at every spring tide. So you know, you're it's very flat through there. Any questions about that particular option? Or concept, I guess. The next concept that we looked at was potentially raising the whole area. You know, it would be a really good option, except for one fundamental problem, is that underneath this whole parking lot is unknown material that is likely very poor quality. There's a number of wharves that are still in here, an old rail bed. I think it was a rail bed, from what we could tell from the photos. You know, those spots would probably stay nice and high and dry if you were to put new material on there. But everything around that would have a tendency to sink and settle. And you'd be constantly going back over time and fixing it, and, you know, probably annually, you know, having to repave areas for quite some time until it would settle out, if it ever did settle out. although I think, you know, it could be a viable solution, if that wasn't the issue, you could be into, millions and millions of dollars chasing that. Either, you know, dig it all out at the beginning, which again would be, you know, millions of dollars, or you know, coming back and repairing it year after year until it settles, you know, could be, again, millions of dollars. And, you know, I think the risk associated with this is quite high because of the potential short and long-term maintenance costs associated with it. As part of doing this, you would come in and match it, you know, into a contour in here, and you know, you'd have to deal with these businesses somehow. You know, you could try to, you know, effectively waterproof them, or you know, put some sort of a barrier around the front of them, but sometimes those types of solutions can be more expensive than just biting the bullet and relocating them, or you know, temporarily relocating them and rebuilding at a higher elevation, or you know, finding a way to raise the elevation of those few buildings. There's really, there's four primary places that I think are of greatest concern. One being the brewery here, the Legion, Waterfront Plaza being the lowest. This is, I think, second lowest. And then the Salvation Army thrift store. And this is close to the two. I think this is at two, I think this was 2.3 or 2.6. Is that what it says in the report?
Yeah.
And this was just slightly higher.
Yeah,
was it the other way around? Yeah. I think this one's slightly
3.
Higher, isn't it?
No, that's,
yeah, that's
235.
Lower.
Sorry.
That's a little lower, 235, Bank of Montreal, 26.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, when you're only dealing with 6 inches, you know, there are ways, more cost-effective ways to be able to protect those couple of buildings, but these ones that are very, very low would be a much, much costlier venture to try to at least protect for the short term until, you know, sea level rise, you know, 30, 40, 50 years down the road became a problem. And, you know, those buildings are kind of getting close to their life expectancy at that point anyway. You know, the other issues there, you know, as you pointed out earlier, is access related to this street as well, and access to the bridge. You can see here, just again, a depiction of what it would look like. This actually should be filled in. The intent for this option would be to make that sort of a consistent grade and then blend back into the existing contour, you know, or the existing bank that's there. And again, same situation over here. For all the options, this particular corner is about the same solution, just a small berm. We expect that the ground here is better. I think this is likely natural riverbank somewhere in here, and I don't think we would have the same issues with porosity of the underlaying material there. Although you'd have to confirm that, but that's why we just show it as a berm for now. The third concept that we discussed was leaving the parking lot as it is, and then just raising a water street. There's a couple of advantages there. One is it it kind of returns Water Street back to being the main road. This little kink here is kind of ugly. It wouldn't be that way. You'd probably try to make it nice and smooth. I think we're just sort of avoiding this little structure here, but you know, return this back to a two-way road. Likely eliminate this entrance. You know, it's not ideal how close it is to the bridge there now anyway. Allow this parking lot to be a parking lot until it's no longer feasible to do so. Over time, I would see that this area being repurposed, you know, maybe shift the parking over this way a little bit to higher ground, maybe turn this into park, and then in conjunction with that, the area in red here, you can see, you know, up here you would fill that in again to sort of the natural riverbank that's back in here somewhere. And again, I would consider relocating these businesses, or at least raising them in one way or another. There's options on how you would do that.
And if I may, long-term disadvantages or advantages of the options so far, it's basically adaptability. So the first option, which is the seawall, and the second option, which would be basically raising the parking lot, they are good for the short term. But then what is going to happen in 50 years when the sea level rises or when the water levels are higher and you're back, or the town is back to square one? What do we do now? So is it going to be the solution to keep raising and raising and raising and building a higher wall and a higher wall? So the disadvantages of those two first options is that basically they offer limited adaptability. This third option allows a little bit more buffer because it's funded in, it's basically based on the holding the line type of solution, because then it becomes the road becomes your primary line of defense in that area. And as the sea continues approaching, then there is a little bit more opportunity for racing and provides a buffer for changing landscapes and changing uses behind it. So that's basically one of the long-term advantages of that one. But you still have to, in some time, figure out what happens behind it and towards the adjacent areas, which are also at risk. This is just a minimum part of a more entire picture, bigger picture, sorry.
Question. Yes. That roadway there now, that would, you'd be looking at basically in behind the Bank of Montreal, right? The BMO?
Correct.
Yeah.
That would, so you really, your roadway would become the wall.
Essentially, it's the high point, yes.
Yeah, it would be.
So the Bank of Montreal, you say that's at, what,
2.35?
So that could be even safe as it where it is.
Yeah,
or close.
With minor improvements.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, really only you need a little bit of a high point around it, about this much, to get to your 2.5 meter mark, which could be simply a little retaining wall, raise the sidewalk up a little bit around it, a step down into it. You know, you could do that fairly cost effectively.
And even the buildings on the opposite side of it could be, they could have different entryways. If you could compare it without completely just having to take the buildings down.
I think the issue with that is that, you know, again, I think this guy, the Waterfront Plaza, I think is 1.9 meters, if I remember correctly.
So it's below.
So,
1.81.
Sorry?
1.81.
1.81. Mm-hmm. So you've got two and a half feet there that you would have to essentially waterproof. You could do that potentially by wrapping the building somehow, and then, you know, coming up with some sort of a solution at the entrance ways. You know, whether it's a raised entryway and a, you know, a window well kind of scenario, but
and it still has the stormwater part of it that still
right.
blocks.
You still have the potential for stormwater to come down through the rear from the remaining land upstream, creating issues there. So, you know. I